A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking whether meditation shows up in the Bible, or whether there are things that could be read as meditative practices. Not just sitting cross-legged and chanting, but things like seeking solitude in the wilderness, the ancient practice of intentional wandering, carving out space for self-awareness. And then the bigger question, how have people throughout history managed to find time for that kind of inner work? Which is really a question about what humans have always needed and how they've structured their lives to get it.
This is one of those topics where the modern framing actually obscures more than it reveals. When people say meditation in the Bible, they're usually looking for something that looks like a headspace session, and they miss what's actually there because it's stressed in different language.
Because the word meditation itself is doing a lot of work here, what does it even translate from?
This is where it gets interesting. The Hebrew Bible has a word that appears repeatedly, haga, spelled ha, gimel, ha. It means to murmur, to mutter, to speak under one's breath, and it's used in contexts that are unmistakably meditative. Joshua chapter 1 verse 8 says, "You shall meditate on this book of the Torah day and night." But the verb there is haga. It's not silent reflection. It's a low, rhythmic vocalization.
Less clear your mind, and more. Mutter the text to yourself until it sinks into your bones.
And that's a practice that survived in Jewish tradition for millennia. You see it in the way yeshiva students study. The room isn't silent. It's full of people murmuring texts aloud, rocking slightly. That's haga. It's a form of meditation that's entirely text-anchored rather than breath-anchored.
There's another Hebrew word that comes up in this conversation. Hitbodedut.
This one is fascinating. Hit bodedut comes from the root bet daled, daled meaning alone or isolated. It literally means self-seclusion, and it becomes a central practice in Hasidic Judaism, particularly in the Breslov tradition. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, this is late 18th, early 19th century, taught that every person should set aside time each day to go somewhere completely alone, ideally in a field or forest, and just speak to God in their own words in their own language.
A field or forest. So we're already at nature's solitude as a structured practice, not just something monks do.
And Nachman was specific about this. He said the best place is among trees and grass, away from other people. The practice involves speaking aloud, not formal prayer, but a kind of unstructured stream of consciousness conversation with the divine. You tell God everything. Your worries, your frustrations, your hopes. You can even argue. The point is raw honesty and isolation.
Which sounds remarkably like certain forms of contemplative practice that modern psychology now recommends. Journaling, but spoken. Processing emotions in a safe space. The mechanism is similar, even if the theological framework is different.
What's striking is that Nachman didn't invent this out of nowhere. He was codifying something that had antecedents going way back. The idea of going into the wilderness to be alone with God is woven through the entire biblical narrative.
Let's go there. Because Daniel's prompt specifically mentioned wandering in the wilderness as something with ancient origins.
The wilderness is arguably the single most important setting in the Hebrew Bible after the temple. The Hebrew word is midbar, and it's not exactly forest. It's wild, uncultivated land. Desert, scrubland, places where humans don't live. And it functions as a kind of spiritual crucible throughout the text.
40 years of it, famously.
Right. But it's not just the Israelites in Exodus. Look at the pattern. Moses flees to the wilderness of Midian after killing the Egyptian. He spends 40 years there as a shepherd before the burning bush. That's not incidental. The text is telling you something about what solitude in wild places does to a person. Elijah flees to the wilderness and has his most intimate encounter with God at Mount Horeb. Not in the wind or the earthquake, but in what the King James Version calls a still small voice. The Hebrew is Kael Demama Daka. A voice of thin silence.
That's a phrase.
It's extraordinary. And then you've got David, who spends years hiding in the wilderness while Saul hunts him. Many of the psalms that people now use for contemplative prayer were written in that context. Psalm 63 opens with, O God, you are my God, earnestly I seek you, my soul thirsts for you, my body longs for you, in a dry and weary land where there is no water.
The physical landscape and the internal state are mirroring each other.
And that's not just poetic, it's a recognition that environment shapes consciousness. The wilderness strips away distractions. There's no court, no city, no market. Just you and the elements and whatever you brought with you internally.
This connects to something I've thought about before. Judaism doesn't have a monastic tradition. No desert fathers, no isolated monasteries. The spiritual ideal in Judaism is engagement with the world, marriage, community, raising children, building institutions. But the wilderness keeps showing up as a temporary retreat, not a permanent withdrawal.
The wilderness is a place you go through, not a place you stay. Even the 40 years in the desert is a passage, not a destination. And that pattern, temporary retreat for the sake of returning with clarity, is actually closer to what most modern meditation practice looks like than permanent monasticism is.
The meditation retreat industry is basically selling a controlled wilderness experience. Go to a quiet place, strip away your normal life, sit with yourself, then come back.
People pay thousands of dollars for this. The Israelites got it for free, though the food situation was reportedly mixed.
The original meal replacement.
Here's what I find genuinely moving about the biblical wilderness tradition. It's not a spa retreat. It's not comfortable. The wilderness is dangerous. There are actual threats. Starvation, thirst, wild animals, hostile tribes. People complain constantly. The Book of Numbers is basically a chronicle of people having a very bad time and being extremely vocal about it.
Which, honestly, is more realistic than the serene meditator image. Inner work isn't always peaceful.
Not at all. And the text doesn't pretend otherwise. Moses has moments of profound doubt. Elijah asks God to just let him die. Jeremiah curses the day he was born. These are not Instagram meditation influencers.
Cursed be the day I was born is not a great caption for your sunset yoga photo.
Though it would be honest. But this gets to the second part of Daniel's prompt. How did people throughout history actually carve out time for this? Because one response is, they didn't, or at least not in the way we imagine. For most of human history, the idea of carving out time for self-awareness as a distinct activity would have been incomprehensible. Not because people weren't self-aware, but because self-awareness wasn't a separate category from the rest of life. It was built into the rhythm of daily activities.
Weaving, plowing, walking, keeping watch over sheep at night.
If you're a shepherd in the ancient Near East, you spend enormous stretches of time alone with your thoughts. You don't need to schedule a meditation session. Your life is the meditation session. The repetitive, low-stimulation nature of pre-modern work created natural conditions for what we now call mindfulness.
Which raises the question of whether the modern problem, how do I find time for self-awareness, is actually a problem created by modern life specifically. We've engineered silence and solitude out of our days so thoroughly that we now have to engineer them back in.
This is the great irony. A medieval farmer didn't need a meditation app. His day was full of rhythmic, repetitive tasks performed in relative quiet, walking behind a plow for hours. These are inherently contemplative activities.
My leaf medicine preparation is extremely contemplative.
Your leaf medicine preparation is medically dubious.
That's a separate question.
The point stands. The question, how did people find time for self-awareness, assumes that self-awareness was a discrete activity you needed to find time for, rather than something woven into the texture of existence.
Though that's not the whole story. Because we do have evidence that people deliberately sought out solitude for spiritual purposes across cultures and across millennia. The biblical wilderness tradition is one example. But you also have the desert fathers and mothers in early Christianity, 3rd and 4th century, people moving out into the Egyptian desert specifically to be alone with God.
That's a fascinating case because it's a reaction to a specific historical moment. Christianity becomes legal in the Roman Empire under Constantine. Suddenly, you don't have martyrs anymore. The church becomes an institution. And some people look at this and say, where's the radical edge? Where's the total commitment? So they go to the desert.
The desert as a protest against respectability.
Anthony the Great, often called the father of monasticism, goes out into the Egyptian desert around 270 CE. And by the time he dies, there are thousands of people living as hermits in the desert. This becomes a massive movement.
They're not just sitting there. There's a whole literature of their sayings. The Apophthegmata Patrum, the sayings of the Desert Fathers.
Which is remarkably practical stuff. A young monk comes to an elder and says, Abba, give me a word. And the elder says something like, go, sit in your cell will teach you everything. Or another one, a monk says, I have fled from the world. And the elder says, the world is a circle and the center is everywhere.
That's not bad.
It's profound. And it comes out of a practice of sustained solitude that most modern people would find terrifying. These people lived alone in caves and small huts for decades. They had no entertainment, no social interaction except occasional visits, no distractions at all. They faced themselves completely.
Which sounds like it could go very well, or very badly.
It went both ways. The literature is honest about this. Some people went into the desert and found profound peace. Others went into the desert and found what they described as demonic attack, but which we might now describe as severe psychological distress. The desert strips away your defenses. Whatever's inside you comes out.
The tradition itself recognizes that solitude is not inherently therapeutic. It's a catalyst. It amplifies whatever is already there.
That's a useful corrective to the modern assumption that a meditation retreat will automatically make you feel better. It might make you feel much worse before it makes you feel better. The Desert Fathers knew this. They called it the Dark Night, a term John of the Cross would later develop in the 16th century.
Let me pull us toward a thread that's running through all of this. Whether it's biblical Haga, or Hasidic Het Bodedut, or the Desert Fathers, or even the rhythmic labor of pre-modern life, there's something about repetition and low stimulation that keeps showing up.
The mechanism is strikingly consistent across cultures and eras. Reduce external input. Engage in a repetitive activity, whether that's murmuring a text, walking, breathing, or weaving. Allow the mind to settle. What rises to the surface, you deal with.
The biblical version of this adds something specific. It's relational. The solitude is not empty solitude. It's solitude in the presence of someone. Het Bodedut is not about emptying the mind. It's about talking to God in your own words. Haga is not about transcending thought. It's about absorbing sacred text until it becomes part of you.
This is a key distinction between Eastern and Western contemplative traditions, though it's often overstated. The popular caricature is that Eastern meditation is about emptying the mind, and Western prayer is about filling it with words. But the reality is more nuanced. Both traditions have practices that involve focused attention on a single object, whether that's a mantra, a text, the breath, or an image. The object differs, but the cognitive mechanism is similar.
Focused attention training. That's the secular term, right?
And the research on this is robust. Focused attention practices, regardless of the object of focus, produce measurable changes in brain function. Default mode network activity decreases. Attentional control improves. Emotional regulation gets better. The mechanism doesn't seem to care whether you're focusing on the Jesus prayer or your breath or a mantra.
Which suggests that the biblical traditions were tapping into something universal about human cognition, even if they described it in theological language.
They were doing it long before anyone had an fMRI machine. The psalmist who wrote, I meditate on you in the night watches, that's Psalm 63 again, was describing a practice that we can now observe neurologically. The night watches were specific periods of the night when guards would be on duty, so this is someone deliberately using the quiet hours of the night for contemplative practice.
The night as a resource, which makes sense. If you live in a pre-modern household, nighttime might be the only time you're alone.
This pattern persists. You see it in monastic traditions where monks rise in the middle of the night for prayer, the vigils, or nocturnes. The idea is that the world is quiet, the demands of the day haven't started, and the mind is in a different state.
There's something about 3 a.m. that makes the usual defenses go quiet.
The French call it l'heure bleue, the blue hour, though that's technically twilight.
I thought the blue hour was just when photographers get the best light.
It's both. But the psychological phenomenon is real. Anyone who's been awake at 3 a.m. knows that thoughts feel different, more raw, more unfiltered, the desert at night, so to speak.
We've got biblical muttering, Hasidic forest talking, desert hermits night watches. What about the other part of Daniel's question? The practice of wandering. Is there an actual tradition of intentional, contemplative wandering?
Yes, and it shows up in multiple traditions. In the Christian tradition, you have the practice of peregrinatio, sacred wandering. The Irish monks in particular were known for this. They would set out in small boats without oars, literally letting God and the currents decide where they went.
That's either profound faith or profound recklessness.
Why not both? The point was to abandon control, to trust completely in providence. Columba goes to Iona. Brendan allegedly reaches North America. These were not vacations. They were deliberate acts of displacement, leaving home, leaving security, placing yourself entirely in God's hands.
In the biblical text itself, wandering is not always voluntary. The Israelites don't choose 40 years in the desert. Abraham is told to leave his homeland without knowing the destination. The wandering is imposed.
It's imposed for a purpose, at least in the narrative's theological logic. The wilderness wandering in Exodus and Numbers is explicitly framed as a period of testing and formation. Deuteronomy chapter 8 says God led them through the wilderness to humble them, to test them, to know what was in their hearts.
To know what was in their hearts. That's self-awareness right there, framed as divine pedagogy.
The wilderness reveals you to yourself, and the text is clear that what gets revealed isn't always flattering. The Israelites complain. They build a golden calf. They want to go back to Egypt. The wilderness doesn't make them instantly holy. It exposes their anxieties, their attachments, their lack of trust.
Which, again, sounds more like actual meditation experience than the idealized version.
Because it is. Anyone who's done a long retreat or committed to a daily practice will tell you that a lot of what comes up is not peaceful. It's restlessness, boredom, irritation, old grievances, random cravings. The mind does not want to be still. It fights back.
The golden calf as the mind's refusal to sit with uncertainty.
That's actually a useful reading. Moses goes up the mountain. He's in this profound state of communion, and he's gone for 40 days. The people at the bottom can't handle the ambiguity. They need something tangible, something they can see and touch. So they build an idol. The need for certainty, for something solid, overrides the capacity for trust.
This is in the text. It's not a modern psychological reading imposed from outside. The narrative itself is about what happens when people are forced to sit in the unknown.
Which brings me to something I think gets missed in a lot of popular discussion of meditation and mindfulness. The biblical and pre-modern traditions are not primarily about stress reduction. They're not about productivity or better sleep or any of the instrumental benefits we now associate with meditation. They're about transformation, about becoming a different kind of person.
The modern wellness industry has extracted the technique and discarded the purpose.
To a large extent, yes. And I'm not saying the instrumental benefits aren't real, they are, and the research backs them up. But if you read the Psalms, or the Desert Fathers, or Nachman of Breslov, they're not trying to lower their cortisol levels. They're trying to encounter God, or understand themselves, or become capable of love, or face their own death.
The big stuff.
The biggest stuff. And that's what makes the question of, how did people find time for this, so interesting? Because if meditation is just a wellness technique, then it's competing with exercise and meal prep and all the other things you're supposed to do for your health. But if it's about the fundamental orientation of your life, then the question shifts. It's not, how do I fit this in? It's, what is my life actually organized around?
For most pre-modern people, their lives were organized around things that created natural space for contemplation. Religious obligations structured the day and the week and the year. Agricultural work had built-in rhythms of intensity and followness. Community was close and constant, but so was solitude. Because privacy as we understand it didn't exist, but being alone with your thoughts while working did.
The Sabbath is relevant here, a full day every week where normal productive activity stops. In Jewish tradition, this isn't just a day off. It's a day for something. For study, for prayer, for being with family, for simply existing without the pressure to produce.
A weekly wilderness, in temporal form rather than spatial.
That's a lovely way to put it, and it's been practiced continuously for over 2,500 years. That's a remarkable data set on the human need for regular disengagement from productive labor.
Though I suspect if you told the ancient Israelites that their Sabbath observance was a wellness practice, they'd look at you strangely.
They'd say it's a commandment, which is another thing the modern framing misses. Obligation could be freeing. If meditation is just something you do when you feel like it, then on the days you don't feel like it, which is most days, you won't do it. But if it's built into a structure of obligation, you do it regardless, and the benefits accrue over time.
The paradox of discipline, freedom through constraint.
Which is exactly what the monastic traditions understood. The rule, the structured schedule of prayer, work, and study, wasn't seen as oppressive. It was seen as liberating. It removed the burden of having to decide every moment what to do next.
If we're trying to answer the question directly, how did people throughout history carve out time for self-awareness and self-exploration? The answer seems to be, they didn't carve it out, because it was already structured into their lives. And when it wasn't, they created institutions and practices to ensure it was.
Those institutions varied enormously. You have the Israelite practice of wilderness retreat, temporary, communal in origin, but individually experienced. You have the prophetic tradition of solitary encounter, Moses, Elijah, Jeremiah. You have the wisdom tradition, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, which is essentially a record of sustained reflection on human life. You have the psalmist practice of night meditation. You have the later Jewish development of Hit-Bodedut. You have the Christian desert tradition. You have the Irish peregrinatio. You have the monastic hours.
That's just in the Abrahamic traditions. We haven't even touched the Eastern traditions, which have their own rich history.
And the common thread across all of them is the recognition that self-awareness doesn't happen automatically. You have to create conditions for it. Whether that's a day of rest, a retreat to the desert, a set of prayer times, a practice of sacred wandering, or a commitment to muttering sacred text under your breath. The form varies, but the underlying insight is the same.
The forms are actually interesting in themselves, because they're not arbitrary. The night, when the world is quiet and the mind is naturally more introspective. The wilderness, where external stimulation is minimal and you can't distract yourself. Repetition, which occupies the surface mind and lets deeper things emerge. Solitude, which removes the performance of self that happens around other people.
This is something that gets overlooked. Many of these traditions involve speaking aloud. Haga is vocalized. Hit-Bodedut is spoken. The Desert Fathers gave verbal counsel. Even the Psalms were sung. There's something about externalizing the internal that these traditions understood.
Thoughts are slippery. Words are more solid. Speaking them makes them real enough to examine.
Hearing yourself speak, there's a feedback loop there. You learn what you actually think by hearing what you say. This is why therapy works, why journaling works, why talking to a friend works. The act of articulation clarifies.
What do we do with all of this? If someone's listening and thinking, okay, I'm not a shepherd, I don't live near a desert, and I'm not joining a monastery, what's the takeaway?
I think the takeaway is that the need is not new, and the practices are not arbitrary inventions. They're discovered and rediscovered across millennia because they work with the grain of human cognition. And the specific form matters less than the commitment to creating space for interiority in a life that will otherwise fill every available moment with noise.
The Sabbath principle. You have to stop in order to notice what's there when you stop.
The wilderness principle. You have to occasionally remove yourself from the environments that constantly demand performance.
The muttering principle. You have to externalize the internal somehow.
The muttering principle. I'm going to call it that from now on.
Put it on a mug.
Seriously, the biblical and historical record suggests that humans have always needed this. It's not a luxury, and it's not a modern invention dressed up in ancient clothing. It's a recognition that we don't automatically understand ourselves. We have to do something to gain that understanding. And the something almost always involves stillness, solitude, and some form of sustained attention.
Which is harder now than it's ever been, because we've built a world that actively prevents all three of those things.
That's why the question of how did people find time for this is so pointed. They didn't have to find time. The time was there, built into the structure of life. We've dismantled those structures, and now we're trying to rebuild them individually, which is much harder.
Though not impossible.
People do it every day. But it helps to know that you're not trying to invent something new. You're trying to recover something ancient that your circumstances have made difficult.
That puts the struggle in a different light. It's not a personal failing that you find it hard to maintain a meditation practice. It's that you're swimming against a current that most of human history didn't have to fight.
which might be the most useful thing we can say. The difficulty is real. It's not you. The environment is hostile to interiority. That doesn't mean give up, but it does mean stop feeling guilty about how hard it is. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, Soviet scientists in Kyrgyzstan discovered that the bright red pigment in certain local wild tulips could be extracted and used as a non-toxic dye for coloring the identification stripes on military parachute cords, replacing a synthetic dye that had been corroding the nylon fibers.
Of course, it was parachute cords.
Kyrgyzstan's contribution to aerial safety, apparently. Thank you, Hilbert.
The things we learn on this show.
If you want to go deeper on any of this, the wilderness tradition, the history of solitude, what the Bible actually says about contemplative practice, head over to myweirdprompts.com where we've got show notes and links to some of the sources we drew on.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumentop. We'll be back next week.
Until then, may your wilderness be productive and your muttering be holy.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.